Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business. I'm Adam Boileau. This week's episode is brought to you by Trail of Bits, who do all sorts of really proper, interesting security research. Tom talked to their CEO, Dan Guido, this week on the channel. And as usual with that guy, like whenever you listen to him talk, you come away with a bunch of interesting questions and interesting ideas and, you know, that sort of itchy feeling in your brain, which is always a good sign when it comes to new and interesting security stuff. Speaking of Tom, how are you doing, Tom?
Yeah, good, Adam. How are you?
I'm doing well. So this week for the newsletter, you wrote up a report that came out of Google Mandiant looking into the notorious GRU hacking group Sandworm. And they've been around for so long that there's literally a book by Andy Greenberg about Sandworm. So what's Mandiant got to say about, you know, what they've been up to and, you know, they've been very busy, I suppose, lately.
There was two interesting things in this report. One was that Mandiant portrays Sandworm as a proliferation risk. And the idea here is that they're a risk just because they do all sorts of wild and crazy things that basically inspire other hostile actors. So I thought that was interesting in that cyber proliferation is different from conventional weapons or nuclear, where it's the technology or the parts or the designs or the intellectual property. And for these kind of cyber operations, it can be as little as just the idea of doing this thing.
Yeah, so like the idea of going after the power grid in Ukraine, which was, you know, a thing they did pretty early on, like that's prompted a bunch of people to think about critical infrastructure security, right? So yeah, it's idea proliferation.
Yeah. And then the second thing was that they stepped through how Sandworm has operated during the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So they've got a timeline of its activities, how it initially started off with some pretty spectacular destructive operations, particularly their action to disrupt Ukrainian military satellite communications by attacking the KASAT network. And then there was a series of disruptive wiper operations around the same time as the invasion, a kind of period of rebuilding and regaining access, more destructive operations. And then they've, towards the later part, over the last year or so, pivoted to more espionage operations. And so this is interesting for people who are trying to figure out what's the role of cyber operations in warfare. Where's the, you know, where do they fit in? How do they play with other conventional military activities? And so one way of looking at that is that Sandworm has just been learning by doing, and it has gradually kind of settled on more espionage operations. So the report actually talks about how they're providing actual tactical support to military efforts in the field. So helping to extract telegram and signal messages from mobile devices, and also, interestingly, targeting the drone supply and logistics networks. And those felt like very the type of things that somewhere like NSA or Cyber Command would not get involved in, because a competent military would say, we're going to capture mobile devices on the battlefield and we're going to have some well thought out process from the get go to do forensics and incorporate that and ingest it. And it felt very much to me like Sandworm is just the group in the Russian military that never says no. So if someone says, oh, we've got mobile phones, who's going to deal with this?
Who knows how to computer, yeah.
Yeah. So they'll just go, yes, we'll deal with it. We've got a satellite network that we want you to disrupt. Can you do that? Yes.
Which, I mean, to be honest, sounds like a pretty fun workplace. I mean, you know, you don't want to be sitting around doing boring hacking work. And I guess having interesting and strange requirements where you have to go build what you need to do it, you know, that's probably quite rewarding work to do. But, you know, that's, as you say, like it's quite a different approach than what I imagine it's like inside, you know, Five Eyes and Western militaries and how we think about those sorts of things.
The way I think about it is you have turf wars that are kind of arranged before the conventional war. So, you know, who's responsible for this? So, you know, maybe NSA is responsible for, you know, forensics of mobile devices from the battlefield, but that would be sorted out well before the actual invasion occurred. Like, you would have this bureaucratic fight beforehand and people would sort it out. Whereas it feels very much like Sandworm is like just saying yes after the fact because no one's thought about it before. So it you know, it's maybe I'm reading tea leaves here, but it felt a bit like a sort of reactive never say no approach. And that kind of, to me, has is interesting in the way that Sandworm does so many things. So they do espionage, they do destructive, they do information operations. And in a Western context, you'd have organizations going, well, that's not our role, that's someone else's role, we specialize in this. And you'd have different authorities that actually delineate who does what. So I just thought that was a very different way of operating. And because it's so expansive or audacious, like that's why it's possibly gives other actors ideas about what to do or how to behave.
Yeah, I mean, certainly NotPetya was a pretty stunning, you know, I mean, when that went down, like that was a pretty stunning thing to watch unfurl. And then also, you know, watching it go off the rails so quickly and turn into a, you know, into a global thing compared to something like Stuxnet, which went off the rails in a very kind of slow motion, you know, long, presumably lots of turf wars involved process as that escaped from where it was meant to be. So it's definitely interesting comparing and contrasting those. And I know when you and Grok have been talking through on the Between Two Nerds podcast, talking through how cyber has been used in the Ukrainian conflict, it's just been really interesting, you know, seeing our understanding, you know, start to, you know, become a bit more well-rounded. Because before the situation in Ukraine really kicked off, we were all, you know, sitting there expecting maybe some, you know, cyber Pearl Harbor or all the things we've been promised for so long, that then, you know, as you said, Viasat, great example of an interesting attack, but ultimately, you know, not that effective in terms of, you know, making their initial invasion of Ukraine go well. And, you know, I do wonder, you know, because the proliferation goes like both down into, you know, criminal groups, but also to other countries where we can look at it and see how they've reacted. And, you know, were there lessons, like, is it too soon to start drawing lessons from Ukraine and the way Russia has, you know, done the cyber there? Or are we still, you know, a couple of years out from learning stuff?
I think it's never too soon because, and I say that because you don't want to just wait and wait and wait before making a decision and doing something. And so I think that in this case, there's lots of countries that are thinking about what's the role for cyber operations.
Yeah.
So a couple of things are clear, that cyber operations are just another part of warfare, right? So the entire time Sandworm has been involved in the war, it's not irrelevant to a war. So that's the first thing. The other thing is that those cyber operations started years and years before the war. So it's a regular part of how countries, I guess, compete with each other, even in peacetime. So if you're not paying attention, even in peacetime, you're behind the eight ball. So you need something. And then I think having a good espionage capability is a must-have, right? Yeah. That's the first thing you would do. And then there's still a question about how much can you expect from an offensive capability. So to me, so far, what we've learned is that there was the potential for some of those destructive actions to have a significant impact. And so all countries, I think, have to be exploring, what do we do in this space? How far do we go? And it seems to me you should be making some investments, but not betting the house on that kind of operation making a huge difference in the war, war.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And it's, I think the Ukraine conflict has also been really interesting at seeing how resilient Ukraine has been at weathering some of those destructive attacks. I mean, having entire banks or telcos having all of their computers wiped and all of the other things that have happened to them. And by and large, they've recovered pretty quickly. And yeah. You look at the Chinese prepositioning, you know, with the Volt Typhoon that we've seen the US, you know, making quite a lot of noise about. And part of me wonders, you know, like, do we think that all of that work is going to have been effective, or have the US blunted the effectiveness of that?
Yeah.
And indeed, even if they didn't, you know, is the US actually resilient enough to weather the sorts of things that have happened in Ukraine? Can you imagine, you know, Verizon being RM'd off the internet in the same way that some of the telcos in Ukraine have been? We can look at this conflict and look at things that Sandworm and Ukraine have been doing, but there's, you know, the how recovery works, I think, has also been really, really interesting.
Yeah, I think, I fall prey to the fascination of offensive cyber activities, but I think you're right that the actual resilience is probably the most important thing to take out of the war. That rather than focusing on an offensive capability, you should probably focus on internal resilience, full stop.
Yeah, it's certainly a very broadly applicable thing to have, you know, being able to deal with disasters, even if they're natural disasters, not necessarily, human caused ones. But I'm thinking when I, in my pen testing time, when we'd sit around and talk through with the customer, like, here are the things we could have done. How long do you think it would take you to recover from? And the kind of estimates we would get from, hey, we can delete your backups and we can encrypt your files or whatever it is, turn off your VMware cluster, all of those estimates were months. And yeah, we've seen Ukraine turn around recovery in days, which...
Yeah, there was that case of a telco getting pretty badly done over. And the CEO later came out and said that if the Russians had been able to go one step further, it would have taken months. But they'd stopped them before. I can't remember what that next step was. I think it was wiping a whole lot of, like, thousands of devices that were close to the edge of the network.
Yeah, out in the field, yes. Because anytime you have to roll truck, it gets slower.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's an element of luck there as well. But I think you need both. You need preparation and a little bit of luck, or you make your own luck or something like that. But I think you're totally right. Like, resilience is useful all the time for all sorts of reasons. Having a top-notch offensive cyber capability is useful in a very small slither of scenarios that hopefully never eventuate anyway.
Yeah, hopefully. So one of the other things you wrote about this week was Section 702 of FISA being reauthorized in the United States. But we all here at RiskyBiz, I think, we're pretty over Section 702. Like, there's been so much coverage and we've had to talk about it so often over the years. So I was thinking that perhaps we could talk about not Section 702. One of the other things that you talked about this week, though, was this kind of academic study trying to arrive at a world cybercrime index. You know, this conversation about resilience and learning lessons from what's been happening to other people. This also seems interesting in the same way. So yeah, tell us about this study.
Yeah, yeah. So the study is really trying to answer the question, which countries are home to the most cyber criminals? And of course, like cybersecurity, cybercrime is a vast field. And so it divvied up cybercrime into five different, they call them threats. So there's kind of the country that is best at making technical products or services, the country that hosts the most attack and extortion type cyber criminals, the country that hosts data and identity theft, scams, and cashing out money laundering. And the way they did this is they basically got together a selection of experts from around the world. And so they take steps to make sure that they're not too Anglo-centric. They've got global coverage. They make sure, or at least take steps to try and get credible experts. And then they just basically gave them a survey. And so what I thought was interesting is that some of the index matches what was in my head. So, no surprise, Russia and Ukraine come first. But it was a surprise to me to see China ranked third overall. And so, for context, this was a crime index and not a state-sponsored index. So, if it's state-sponsored, China is probably one or two, right? But I don't hear a lot about Chinese cyber criminals. And so to me, what this index is saying is that I read a lot of English language reporting on cybercrime and I'm missing out on a whole lot of Chinese language, either because it's not reported. I mean, the PRC is notorious for its censorship. Or it's not making it into English language material that I can search for and read about.
When the stuff about like the pig butchering scam call centers in Southeast Asia and Myanmar and so on, like I remember being surprised at the scale of that, and then the fact that that was targeting a lot of victims in China was interesting, because we hadn't really, I don't recall seeing cybercrime targeting a Chinese audience so much, but of course, why would I, right?
Yeah,
and
that's right.
That's what is interesting about this is that we do have very different perspectives, and we are used to Nigerian scamming being a thing because we experienced that. And I don't know where Nigeria ranks in this particular study, but in terms of mindshare, Nigerian 419 scammers were a pretty early market leader. But yeah, it's interesting to see a more globally even perspective on this kind of thing, because as you say, we do have a Eurocentric bias.
Yeah. So, to answer your question in specific, Nigeria ranked 5, but it was basically because it was top of scams.
Yeah.
So it seemed it seems like that dividing it into different aspects is useful, because then you can say, look, Nigeria is the top scamming nation. And then it was actually India and then Ghana and South Africa. And that kind of makes sense. That sort of feels right. I've got a lot of Indian scams over the years.
Big tech workforce, big population. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. Now, the thing that really surprised me is that the UK actually comes first when it came to money laundering and cashing out.
Mm.
Now, that makes sense because London is such a financial hub.
Yeah,
but it's absolutely not what I would have thought based on the cybercrime reporting that I read.
Yeah, normally we expect that thread to go to, casinos in Macau or something like that. But no, I guess it makes sense that financial hub is where financial stuff happens. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so to me, that's the kind of value in this kind of index, is that it makes you take a second look and think, well, the UK is actually a country that would be motivated to, I guess the word would be crack down on this sort of thing, once it realises that it's a problem.
Yeah.
And so just pointing out that it's a potential problem, I'm no index like this is perfect, because it's just kind of a sampling of people.
Yeah, it's a lot of fingers in the air.
That's right. Yeah. And at the very least, it should make regulators in the UK have a deeper look. What's the, why do people think this? What is there a loophole that's being exploited? What can we do about it? And maybe there's nothing there, because it is an index made up of experts. But I think it forces you to, or asks the question that demands a second look. And then it's also useful for things like capacity building. What would you like to teach a country? So for example, Brazil. Brazil comes actually relatively high in terms of countries that are homes for the technology that's used in malware. And so Brazil seems like a country where you could get some traction teaching police forces there how to prosecute those kinds of crimes. And so it allows you to tailor your efforts in different countries to the problems that exist or that we believe exist in that country. If you're thinking about where to spend money or where to invest effort in tackling cybercrime at its source, it's a useful resource that you should have a look at.
All right. Well, excellent. Thank you for bringing it to everyone's attention. And thank you for talking to me today. Pat will be back next week, so you'll probably be chatting to him. But yes, everyone, hope you've enjoyed the show and have a read of Tom's newsletter. Thanks very much, Tom.
Thanks, Adam.